me a story of what happened at his high school to illustrate his theme. There were two guys, 17, rivals. One borrowed a book from the other about Kim Il-sung's exploits fighting the Japanese. He scribbles on it, gives it back, and that's the end of it. Every 2 or 3 months, ideology thought police come round to people's houses. They see the scribbles on the book about the great leader, and the whole family goes to the gulag. Later, the secret came out, and the guy who did it brags about it. He got away with it. No one ratted him up. Those kind of incidents happened all the time. I heard one story of a gang of kids fighting in front of a statue of Kim Il-sung. This 13-year-old throws a bottle and the great leader's ear falls off. It's plaster, painted bronze, and the whole family goes to the gulag. How do you know that for sure? There's a network of rumors. Someone will have seen them taken away in trucks. My translator Guan and I told Sam about the problems we had had with two North Koreans who met us and then declined to make any criticism of the country at all, even saying that the health system in North Korea was just like the NHS. As bad as casualty can be on a Friday night in any British hospital, I found that statement incredible. Even though their bodies are here in London, their minds are still in North Korea. They have nightmares. They are afraid to speak. Do you have nightmares? Sam said he didn't, but I didn't quite believe him. He spent 8 years in the army, where, he says, he was constantly brainwashed. Sam was stationed at the DMZ for much of his time in uniform. I asked him about power supply. Power only works 24/7 in the mausoleum and for the electrified fence at the DMZ, for the dead and the dead to come. Soldiers in the army back in the day used to be well fed, said Sam, but once the famine hit, even in the army people suffered. One third could get by, one third starved, one third went AWOL to go back home just because they wanted a good meal. Sam's job was to go around the whole of North Korea tracking down the runaways and bringing them back to the DMZ. Such was the degree of social compliance inside North Korea that pretty much all he had to do was have a word with the soldier's parents and the runaway would meekly return with him. Did he feel guilty? He explained that at first, at the very start of the famine years, deserters would be sent to the gulag. But as time went by, the punishment became weaker. The reason they were going AWOL was hunger. Parents asked him to punish their sons quietly. Hush, hush. I was part of a regiment, not the secret police. I would go from place to place and bring the boys back one by one. Parents would encourage them to go back. It wasn't a difficult job, but something happened to the wall inside his head. The wall which had blocked out doubts. Not the bricks, but the mortar started to flake. In his walled-off mind, first one crack, then another. They began to spread. Sometimes the parents of the soldiers would plead with me. Through my job, I got to speak to a lot of people, and that is how my doubts grew. On buses everywhere, it says, North Korea is the people's nation. It isn't a people's nation. That was a lie. I saw the high-ups living a better life. Before, I had never questioned it. They lived that life because they deserved to live in that position. But later, I did realize that it was wrong. In Pyongyang, I met a woman diplomat, home for a spell, but she normally worked in the embassy in Holland, a superb job, access to the West, to money, to everything. This woman had no pity for the hungry begging for rice. When someone came to ask her for food or money, she almost spat at them. I felt this was wrong. My doubts grew, but inside North Korea there is no frame of reference. We don't know what to compare anything to. Someone who knows, say, white and red will be able to say that's red and white, but if you don't know the difference... You could see that people were dying. I wanted to leave, to find the other perspective. As soon as I left North Korea, I saw straight away. In the summer of 1999, something happened to my niece, Janie. She was 3, a toddler, but because of the famine, she was the size of a 1-year-old. Janie found some dried, raw corn and stuffed herself. The dried corn makes you very dehydrated, so she drank too much water, and her tummy expanded like a drum, and she ruptured her stomach. She was a tiny kid, but her stomach expanded to the size of a basketball. She looked like a bird hit by a car. She died. I can still see the blue veins on her tummy. When people came to pay their respects, they couldn't look. It was so gruesome. We were sitting in the back of the travel agency, Guan's parents own in New Malden. Outside, the traffic went about its business, people from Wimbledon popping in to see their mum in Surbiton, going to the local tip, to the movies. Inside, as bleak a tragedy as you ever did hear. After a long silence, Sam continued his story. The death of my niece broke something inside my head. I was determined to get out. But it took me 5 more years to overcome my doubts. We all knew the risks. The border guards might shoot you, trouble for your family. In the summer of 2005, my job, picking up AWOL soldiers, had taken me to the far northeast, near the border with China. I rounded up 7 deserters, sent them back to the DMZ, and moved closer to the Tumen River. It was August, and there was a full moon. I had to wait for 3 days until clouds came, blanketing out the moon. The river is fast and deep, but not that broad up in the mountains. The problem is that in summer the level is down, so you have to crawl over 500 yards of pebbles before you get to the river proper, and the sound carries at night. If the guards hear the pebbles move, they could shoot you. I thought to myself, do or die. I'm going to die in the gulag or die fighting. To demonstrate his pebble-crossing technique, he took off his chalk-striped jacket and laid it on the floor. He moved it ahead of him, fully at arm's length, then wriggled his body forward so that it rested on the jacket. Then the process started again, all the while keeping his body as low as can be. To move across 500 yards of pebbles, it took me 3.5 hours. The river was only 100 feet wide, but the current was quite strong. It took me only 1/2 hour to cross, if that. It was quiet on the Chinese side. Just across this river was a completely different world. I went to an apple orchard. I'd never seen one before. In North Korea, an apple is eaten when it is very small. Did you eat one? I ate 6. Sam had made it across the river, but he still wasn't safe. He hid at night. He had no money, only army uniform. But after a couple of days, he met a Korean Chinese who helped him find his feet in China, and then he was on his way to freedom. The brainwashing, said Sam, works by blocking out your mind from thinking. My brain was not wired to think critically of the regime. Only after I left North Korea, after I have seen how other cultures work, only now do I know what was wrong. People left back there may somehow sense something is wrong, but they don't know for sure. All of the defectors from North Korea I've interviewed at length, 4 in South Korea, 3 in London, told me that they were brainwashed when they were brought up in North Korea. On Lifton's test number 1, milieu control, all 7 said information was constricted. They didn't know what the rest of the world was truly like until they left. On the second test, mystical manipulation, most, if not all, remembered feeling awe and veneration for the Kim dynasty, especially at school. The third test, the demand for purity, positive too, but this was something I did not press people on much. knowing the facts of the regime's propaganda. The fourth test, the cult of confession, everyone was familiar with. The fifth, the sacred science, is an echo of mystical manipulation, but likewise tests positive. The sixth, loading the language, positive, but again was something else I didn't press people on, knowing the lexicon of regime propaganda. The seventh, doctrine over person, and the eighth, the dispensing of existence. How can those tests not be passed if your country suffers a famine that kills untold numbers and yet the people remain loyal? When the stomach of a starving three-year-old bursts and no one dares deface the pictures of the fat rulers, is that not existence dispensed? This isn't a scientific investigation. You can't do that in a tyranny. But the evidence from the defectors suggests that North Korea passes all of Lifton's tests on brainwashing, and on that rough-and-ready basis, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is a cult, 23 million strong. On the top-floor balcony of the Grand Study House, we had a magnificent view of the city, looking back across Kim Il-sung Square, and beyond that, the river, the Juche Tower, and East Pyongyang. They were testing the public address system for the rally taking place the next day. The disembodied voice echoed out over the city, empty of people, of traffic, terrifyingly loud. The sound of Big Brother. Chapter 14. God the Bad Elvis' Son. For a man born on the day that the Titanic sank, Kim Il-sung lived a long and healthy life. But old age, and then the only end of age, as the poet Philip Larkin warned, creeps up on us all. The antidote to the slide towards death was created by the Kim Il-sung Institute of Health and Longevity. The great leader must consume dog penises, at least 3 inches or 7 centimeters long. And in the meantime, his son slowly tightened his grip on the levers of power. Kim Jong-il is one of the most fascinating villains of history, subtle, charming, gifted, psychotic, cruel, twisted, feckless. It's nigh on impossible to see him clearly through the opaque glass of the dynasty's propaganda or the bubbling vitriol of the defectors. He kept the regime safe in power. He gave North Korea nuclear weapons. He presided over the famine which killed 3 million people. He became an international laughingstock. Clip-clopping around in elevator shoes and bouffant hairdo, he will go down in history as the man who tried to make himself look taller at both ends, the puppet villain of Team America. At times you have to pinch yourself and remember this comedy baddie was flesh and blood. He sent millions to their graves. Kim II's story starts in confusion, with the place and date of his birth hotly disputed, the regime claiming he was born on Mount Baktu, behind the Japanese lines in 1942. Soviet sources and Korean defectors are clear that he was born in a barracks in the Soviet Union, not far from Vladivostok, in 1941. No one quite knows why the regime faked not just the place, but also the date of his birth. His father was born in 1912, so 1942 has a pleasing echo, if you are into the wilder shores of numerology and superstition. Kim II's mother was a vivacious but illiterate peasant, looked down on by other mothers within Pyongyang's elite as someone who knew how to butcher chickens and not much else. Very quickly, the boy god developed a nasty reputation, biting other children, killing bugs, a lonely and guilty child. By the time he was 5, his younger brother was dead. By the age of 7, so was his mother. He was brought up by a hated stepmother, surrounded by uncles and half-brothers and nephews, all of whom had an interest in him being done down. His father was consumed with power and had little time to spend with the boy. Against all communist propriety, Kim Jong-il succeeded in grabbing the chalice of power and passing it on to his least feckless son. In much else, he failed, but in that he took power and passed it on, dying in his bed, he can be counted, like his father, as a tyrant success story. Kim Jong-il was first accused of murder when he was 6 years old, the victim his three-year-old brother. Young Kim was known by his Russian pet name, Yura, his little brother, Shura. The three-year-old died in a swimming pool when the family were back in Pyongyang in 1947. One defector account has it that Yura killed Shura by pushing him back into the pool again and again. If so, Shura would not be the last North Korean to die at the whim of the man who became the second God King. 2 years later, in 1949, his mother, Vera, or Kim Jong-suk, died after complications with an ectopic pregnancy, leaving Kim Jong-il pretty much alone in the world. The regime's official story leaves you at sea about his real upbringing. You come across stuff like Kim at the age of 8 reading Lenin's State and Revolution and writing a commentary on it, and you know that's rubbish. A few years later, during the Korean War, Kim too became a prodigy songwriter, being rude about the Americans. This too is most likely rubbish. What we do know, however, is that when the war quickly went sour for the North, Kim Il-sung spirited his family out to the safety of China, where they sat out the bombing in comfort. In the late 1960s, Kim Jong-il started working on what you could call Pyongyang, or, in regime speak, the cultural sphere. You get the feeling that he was a bit of a stage door Johnny, desperately keen on impressing the actresses. Very soon, of course, it would be the other way around. Early on in his career, he tapped into the importance of knowing what the Buibu, the secret police, knew. Towards the end of his life, he ran it. When he was a child, officials used to bow low. He started his first bespoke purges in his 20s. In 1974, he became a Politburo member, but throughout this time he was never openly and transparently the heir apparent. He rose to power almost invisibly, just like Stalin, whose ascension to the Kremlin was described as being like that of a grey blur. Palace intrigue was the meat and veg of Kim Jong-il's life in his 20s and 30s. He had a lot against him. The biggest weakness was that he had had no experience of revolutionary struggle or the guerrilla war. How could a baby? Throughout his life, he looked small in his father's shadow. His old man was a killer who started a pointless war in which millions died, grew fat while his people starved, purged many entirely innocent colleagues, and created a gulag of the utmost horror. But time and again, witnesses say that Kim Il-sung had real class, something they hesitate to say about his son. For example, one witness said that for the first few years in power, Kim Il-sung still had an attractive personality. Breen tells the story that during his audience with the great leader, someone asked what he did for leisure. The old thing replied, "Soldiers raise bears for me to hunt, but I think that now they hide behind a tree with a tame bear and push it out when I come along." This dictator joke against himself, writes Breen, went down well. Breen goes on to quote a TASS correspondent comparing father tyrant and son. The old man was gracious as usual. The young Kim looked awkward, as if he had swallowed poison. All serious rivals to Kim Jong-il with real guts and vigour were fed into Kim Il-sung's meat grinder. Yet Kim Jong-il played the long game, building up his father's personality cult to ludicrous levels, forever inventing new nonsense, always downplaying his own ambition. Only in 1980, at the 6th Congress of the Korean Workers' Party, was Kim Jong-il officially ordained successor to his father. Long after it had become clear that the party center, as Kim too liked to style himself with typical opacity, was going to get the crown, he remained in the shadows, waiting, waiting, waiting. His greatest accolade was the near-total ignorance of Western intelligence services. People wondered whether he was a half-wit. When the South Korean president, Kim Dae-jung, an enthusiast for the sunshine policy, visited Pyongyang in 2000, people in the South were delighted to discover that their enemy had charm and grace. Kim Jong-il seemed to be no monster. He cracked self-deprecating jokes, was attentive to the South Korean leader, and walked slowly with him. The man from Seoul had a bad limp from a car accident. Told about his newfound popularity down south, Kim too said, "After I appeared on TV screens, I'm sure they came to know that I am not a man with horns on the head." Perhaps he was. Evil hides in murk. The narratives of the people who knew him well and escaped so that they could tell the world are somehow disappointing. The picture that emerges of Kim Jong-il is incoherent, fuzzy, crepuscular. That, perhaps, is testament to his genius as a tyrant, that he made it nigh on impossible for people to read his mind. In Team America, the puppet Kim Jong-il feeds Hans Brix, the comically mispronounced nuclear weapons inspector, to the sharks. Kim is then filmed through the prism of the fish tank containing the late Swede's skeleton, his briefcase holding nuclear secrets still chained to a skeleton wrist. The dear leader indulges in his melancholic song about the trials of life as a tyrant. "I'm so ornery." It turns out that the puppeteer's mix of psychotic violence and queasy sentimentality is bang on the nail. The first and perhaps most thoughtful of our witnesses to the real Kim Jong-il is Hwang Yong-yop, the Juche theorist who became the head of Kim Il-sung University and then defected to the South in 1997, knowing that the regime would send his children and grandchildren to the gulag. Hwang had been Kim Il-sung's man when the great leader was in his pomp. Under Kim I, he rose to the fringes of power, created Juche-ism, and lived a good life. As Kim Jong-il's life force slowly seeped through the corridors of power, Hwang was demoted and, first gently, then not so gently, moved aside. He is, naturally, a hostile witness. Why did he defect? It's not clear. The sense you get from reading his essays and thoughts is that he had to, that his mind would have broken in two had he stayed any longer, genuflecting before a god he despised. It's possible to read Hwang as a materialist, out for number one, who prospered under Kim Il-sung, but fell from grace under his son and decided to quit. But that's not how I read him. Rather, he was a sincere and moral man who had somehow been able to justify his actions under Kim I, but that stance became increasingly difficult under Kim II. Once he decided to escape, he knew for certain what would befall his family, and a feeling of melancholy surrounds his observations. As someone who has tried to grapple with the reality of North Korea, not the fog, I feel profoundly grateful that he did defect and spell things out to the world. At the same time, one cannot help but feel immense sorrow for his children and grandchildren as the doors on their futures slammed shut against them. Hwang's primary verdict is against the father, Kim Il-sung, for allowing his vanity to be the master of his judgment and promote an obviously flawed son to take command. But few dared tell the great leader that his son was sly and bitter and twisted. Every single person who fell inside the Kim dynasty circle knew that their survival and that of their children, unto the third generation, depended on its continuing blessing. The mind-fuck for the great leader, then the dear leader, and now the fat leader, is that if you tell the tyrant bad news, you risk losing your head. But if the only news you ever receive is good, you risk not knowing what on earth is going on. So power passed from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, with the father only dimly aware of who his son really was. And the handful of old warriors who dared to stand up to him were squashed flat like bugs under the thumb. Kwong says that in the 70s, Kim Il-sung's old guard tried to fight against Kim Jong-il's succession. The vice prime minister, Nam Il, raised concerns. He was crushed to death in a road accident when a lorry ran out of control. Author's note, there are no real road accidents in North Korea. Four others also signaled their opposition. They were, according to Goss's report on state terror for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, Park Kum-chul, secretary to the KWP secretariat, Kim Kwang-hyop, former defense minister, Ho Pong-hak, a former four-star general, and Yu Chang-sik, a former senior official. By 1982, all four, according to a defector, were in the gulag. Kim Jong-il loved a racy capitalist version of the good things in life. Fine wines, Hennessy cognac, human beds, mattress and frame constructed of intertwined naked concubines. Huang was something of an old guard Puritan and clearly disapproved. But it's one thing to enjoy a good party, another to have someone shot for dobbing you into your old man. The story Huang tells of one such hapless telltale is grim beyond belief. A woman professor at Kim Il-sung University wrote an anonymous letter to Kim Il-sung complaining about the drinking and whoring at one of Kim Jong-il's parties. She was worried about her husband's attendance. It never got to the great leader, but was intercepted by the secret police, whose master was the dear leader. A grueling investigation began to hunt down the mole. Eventually she was caught. Her husband volunteered to shoot her to show his loyalty, and the dear leader granted permission. Soon after, the husband executioner married a new woman, selected by Kim Jong-il. The lesson for everyone in the palace was simple. Do not raise your hand against the dear leader. Kim Jong-il became obsessed with the idea that people would not tell him the truth, knowing that his hangers-on only told him what he wanted to hear. Huang's biographers tell the story of Kim Jong-il lecturing the chief of police and his acolytes about giving false or too rosy reports. Kim Jong-il said, "I like accurate, true reports." All of you know Ernst Kaltenbrunner, the chief of the SS during the Nazi era. When he made his reports to Hitler, he was always simple and accurate. At times when Himmler, the number two man, exaggerated or altered any information on behalf of Hitler, Kaltenbrunner would correct his superior. I want you to be like Kaltenbrunner. He was not exactly a perfect role model, as his fate suggests. Kaltenbrunner indulged Hitler's fantasies to the very end, and though less dreamy than Himmler, was no less deluded. He was hanged in 1946. Odd, one might think, for Kim Jong-il to know so much about Hitler's inner circle, but tyrants are fascinated by other tyrants. One of the entries for the visitor's book for Stalin's dacha in Sochi, southern Russia, now a creepy hotel where you can sleep in Stalin's bed, I did once and had a terrible night's sleep, was Saddam Hussein. In Baghdad, a Kurdish leader negotiating with Saddam noted that his bookshelves were full of books about Stalin. But Kim Jong-il's fascination with Kaltenbrunner, the honest Nazi, speaks exactly to the primary problem of the North Korean dictatorship, information necrosis. The caprice of the despot even extended to marriage guidance, of a kind. In 1978, Choi An-hee, a South Korean film actress of ravishing beauty, was lured to Hong Kong by a Chinese film executive. She was driven to Repulse Bay, where there was a small white boat waiting on the beach. Suddenly, men leapt from the boat and grabbed Che and forced her on board. The boat pushed off and headed for open sea. "Where is this boat going?" she asked frantically. "Madame Che, we are now going to the bosom of General Kim Il-sung." It wasn't the old man who greeted her when she landed in North Korea, but his son. "Thank you for coming, Madame Che. I am Kim Jong-il," as if she had some choice in the matter. Shin Song-ok, her South Korean ex-husband and a film director, heard about Che's disappearance. In Hong Kong, he too was lured to Repulse Bay in a white Mercedes. The car stopped. Four men got in, threatened Shin at knife point, put a nylon bag entirely over him, and the goons headed off to sea with their human parcel. In the morning, they transferred to a freighter, the Sugun Ho. A few days later, two men in Mao tunics greeted him at Nampo, saying, "Welcome to the socialist fatherland." Neither Shin nor Che knew what had happened to each other. Shin spent 5 years fighting his captors. He escaped for a few hours only to be recaptured and thrown into Prison 6, where, half-starved on thimblefuls of rice and grass, he endured endless indoctrination for 4 years. Tasting bile all the time, I experienced the limits of human beings. Eventually he realized that cunning would be the key to unlock his jail, and went along with Kim Jong-il's whims. He wrote reams of rubbish, praising the dear leader. "What a wretched fate," he recalled towards the very end of his life. "I hated communism, but I had to pretend to be devoted to it to escape from this barren republic. It was lunacy." Eventually, after banks of security screenings, he was taken to a plush villa in Pyongyang and ended up face to face with his ex-wife, who had not known until that moment that he was in North Korea. The dear leader said, "Well, go ahead and hug each other. Why are you just standing there?" The marriage counselor from hell suggested that they remarry. Why? Who knows? They did as they were told. From their accounts, Kim Jong-il was like the psychotic character in the novel The Collector by John Fowles, snatching human butterflies with his net and imprisoning them in a jar. And yet Kim Jong-il does come across in their accounts as weirdly charming. At that first dinner party in Pyongyang in March 1983, when Shin and Che are reunited, the first thing Kim says to Shin is, "Director, forgive my act. I must apologize for this situation in which you have had to suffer so much." After which Kim takes his hand and shakes it. Shin writes, "I instinctively understood the implications behind Kim's words, 'forgive my act.'" Shin doesn't explain explicitly, but he implies that his imprisonment and harsh treatment have been a front that Kim has had to put up to display his authority to others and to Shin, especially as he had tried to escape several times. The next day there was another party, and it was at this party that Kim told Shin that the whole show was bogus. "It's just a pretense." Shin writes that these two blunt statements left a long-lasting impression. After this night, they do not see Kim for another few months, even though he has promised to meet soon after. Shin later finds out that it is because Kim has been on a trip to China. During this time, Shin and Che study North Korean, Chinese, and Russian films. Shin notes that North Korean films combine songs and acting, much like operettas. After a few months, they are invited to Kim II's office, and before they start their talk, Kim switches on his TV to check what's on. To Shin and Che's surprise, Kim is watching South Korean channels, and even notes that one star on a drama show is a very good actress. It is clear that he watches a lot of South Korean TV and films from around the world. Shin and Che were terrified that, if they ever made it back to South Korea, no one would ever believe them that they had been kidnapped. This is long before the regime admitted to kidnapping 13 Japanese citizens in 2008. So they secretly tape-recorded the Dear Leader, the device hidden in Che's handbag. Shin writes, "First, once Kim Jong-il opened his mouth, he didn't seem to know how to stop talking. He hardly allowed us any gaps to speak at all, and he kept on talking one-sidedly. While he spoke, when we tried to say something briefly, he quickly interrupted and carried on talking. His voice was loud and high, and he spoke very fast. There seemed to be so much that he wanted to talk about that it seemed like he could not organize his words as he spoke, so he would stutter at the end of his sentences. When I tried to transcribe what Kim had said, not one sentence he spoke can be written as a complete sentence on paper. The subject noun is normally repeated two or three times. Before one sentence is even complete, he will rush into another sentence, when the point he was trying to make was not clear in the first place, and there were many instances where the beginnings and ends of what he was trying to say did not connect or make sense." Shin transcribed word for word what Kim said. It's fairly long-winded and ranting. He talks about why the recent North-South talks broke down, why he kidnapped Shin and Che, the state of North Korean cinema, what's wrong with it, how he wants to develop it, and how he wants to take films to film festivals, and even maybe set up a film festival in Pyongyang. He came across as bullish, the way he rants endlessly without letting Shin or Che talk. He seems sly but naive at the same time. There does seem to be a lot going on in his mind, but it's muddled and incoherent. On tape, Kim Jong-il says, "The first thing in the North-South relations is the cultural exchange, cultural cooperation. That's what I think. Already people were going back and forth on their own accord, and I asked whether there was a way for you..." This is rubbish. No one goes back and forth between North and South Korea. The cultural exchange happened by force, and Shin and Che were not free to leave. Shin made 7 films in North Korea, with Kim Jong-il his producer. The best, that is least bad, is Pulgasari, about a giant metal-eating monster with a social conscience, similar to the Japanese Godzilla. Film journalist John Gorenfeld summarized the dramatic ending. Pulgasari leads the farmer's army in an assault on the king's fortress, and against thousands of North Korean military troops who were mobilized and dressed up as extras. Ultimately, the king uses his experimental anti-Pulgasari weapon, the Lion Gun, but the enterprising Pulgasari swallows the missile and shoots it back at his oppressors. Finally, the king is crushed beneath a huge falling column. But the monster starts eating the people's tools. Gorenfeld, one of 1,000 people outside North Korea who have seen the movie, carries on. When the blacksmith's daughter tearfully pleads with Pulgasari to go on a diet, he seems to find his conscience and, puzzlingly, shatters into 1,000,000 slow-motion rocks. It's a terrifically bad movie. Shin and Che had a Mercedes, good food, and a $3 million a year budget to make great films in the North, but they hated it. Shin wrote, Living a good life ourselves and enjoying movies while everyone else was not free was not happiness, but agony. In 1986, 8 years after being kidnapped, Shin and his wife went to a film event in Vienna. They gave their minders the slip and hair-tailed it for the American embassy in a taxi. A minder followed in another taxi, but they managed to lose him. Free at last, the film director and his wife had endured an episode far more exciting and incredible than anything in any of their movies. Other eyewitness testimony speaks of Kim Jong-il's subtlety and consideration before mentioning his darker side. For example, Sung Hye-rang, Kim Tu's former sister-in-law, writes, "He is a cultured man and respects knowledge. He enjoys beauty. I think he has inherited some good points, generosity and a warm heart. He was always considerate and wanted to do well by others. His extreme, harsh personality makes him seem like a bad human being." In the same paragraph, two wildly different views of the same man are put forward in neighboring sentences by someone who knew him well, considerate and extreme harsh. The truth is that both are right. Kim Jong-il was like a malfunctioning television set, which much of the time would present a perfect picture, clear, sometimes even beautiful. And every now and then, the set would flicker, then go ponk, and you would see a forest of angry dots and hear a screech of white noise. Power magnifies faults, or, as the old Swahili proverb has it, the higher the monkey climbs the tree, the more you can see its bottom. Mood changes, whims, paranoid insecurity, and absolute power are a bad mix. For people who had to work with him in the lower tiers of power, that mix would prove to be nightmarish. No man is a hero to his valet. Lee Young-kook was a palace bodyguard who managed to escape to the south. He recalls of his master, "He is generally impatient and sly. There's more to him than his pleasant exterior. Inside, he is always scheming, making secret plans, and he is very clever about planning escape routes in case things go wrong. There are two sides to him always. He is not a good listener. He is extremely cruel toward those who disagree with him. Many people have lost their lives trying to point out their problems to him." A courtesan in the palace describes Kim as sensitive, preferring girls of classical beauty, never taller than him, and once he got to know the girls, happy to pass gas to break wind in their company. How very attractive. Not quite the Prince Charming was the view of some of Kim Tu's old military classmates, who in 1992 were accused of plotting against him. They reportedly said that he was incapable and bad-natured, according to Ken E. Goss's report for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. They lost the fight, and 300 senior officers were executed. The sound of the firing squads at work disturbed the night outside one military barracks for a month. One should note that although Kim Il-sung died in 1994, by the turn of 1990, it seems likely that the old man's powers were waning, and that by 1992, Kim Jong-il felt secure enough to stage mass purges of his enemies, real or imagined. This 1992 plot is only one of an astonishing number of conspiracies against Kim Tu, and an astonishing number of executions, cited by Gauss. In 1995, officers of the 6th Army Corps, based in the ever-suspect Northeast, were found to have been plotting against the party center, Kim Tu, and they were executed too. In 1997, writes Gauss, the regime's Operation Intensification targeted Korean Workers' Party officials suspected of sabotaging food supplies. The true cause of the famine, the folly of Kims 1 and 2, was not addressed. This operation led to the rounding up of more than 30,000 officials and their families, many of whom were incarcerated or executed. Top secret policeman Cha Moon Tok went to the firing squad. In 1998, at the height of the famine, people stripped the Hwang Ha Steelworks of machinery to sell and exchange for food. 19 culprits were executed. Jang Jin-song was part of North Korea's propaganda machine. He spent his working day writing syrup in verse about Bad Elvis before he ran away in 2004. The poet met Kim Jong-il twice. The first time, in 1999, he was overwhelmed and full of emotion. But at the same time, he told the BBC, "I thought the image I had received of him, through brainwashing, was very different to how he appeared in person. He is a godlike figure, but when I met him, I felt he was much more individualistic, even a bit selfish, and I was disappointed." Kim too gave Jung a Rolex watch worth, he later worked out when he defected to the South, about $11,000 or £7,000. "Though the population was going hungry," said Jung, "Kim was using gifts as a way of buying loyalty." Once in the royal circle, Jung was protected, even from prosecution. He received the very best level of rations throughout the famine. "I realized North Korea was the poorest country in the world, presided over by the richest king, and that's why I wrote poems that were critical of the regime while I was still there." He got away with it because he never committed them to paper. Selling My Daughter, a poem in Korean by Jang Jin-song. The woman was paper thin, a sign hung from her neck. "Selling my daughter for 100 won." With the little girl standing next to her, the woman stood in the marketplace. The woman was a mute. She gazes at her daughter. Her maternal feelings are being sold. Cursed at by passers-by, the woman stares only at the ground. The woman has no more tears. Clutching her mother's skirt, "My mother's dying," cries the daughter. The woman's lips tremble. The woman knows no gratitude. The soldier gave her 100 won, saying, "I'm not buying your daughter, I'm buying your motherly love." The woman grabs the money and runs off. The woman is a mother. With the 100 won she received for the sale of her daughter, she hurries back, carrying bread. She shoves the bread into her daughter's mouth. "Forgive me," wails the woman. Jun Jing Song poem, 100 won, is roughly equivalent to 73 US cents or 47p. When Jung met Kim Jong-il the second time, it was shocking. "We sat at a performance together, and he kept on crying while he watched it. I felt his tears represented his yearning to become a human being, to become an ordinary person." One more palace witness is a Japanese wide-boy-come-sushi chef adopted by Their Majesties Kim Jong-il and son Kim Jong-un as an all-licensed royal fool. Kenji Fujimoto is a thuggish, drunken, but somehow charming tough who went drinking with the boss, Kim Jong-il, the night before he was to marry a hand-picked courtesan, and woke up with his pubic hair vanished, a practical joke by the palace. Fujimoto's gift to posterity is a number of Bow and Tell books, ghost-written after he fled back to Japan, including The Honorable General Who Loved Nuclear Weapons and Girls, and Kim Jong-il's Cook, I Saw His Naked Body. Fujimoto says of Kim, "Kim Jong-il is a warm person with many hobbies and always wears a smile. But when someone fails to report an important item, or when something goes wrong, he yells and screams into a telephone like a madman. I have often witnessed this. He has no qualms about chewing out senior officials, no matter who they are. The more his people starved, the more Kim Jong-il loved to eat and drink the finest things. Fujimoto was dispatched to the far corners of the world to track down goodies, caviar in Iran, Pilsner beer in the Czech Republic, bacon in Denmark, and regular trips to Japan to buy tuna, sea urchin, and toro sushi, a prize cut of fatty marbled tuna. Kim, too, was a night owl and would often demand a lavish meal at 2 o'clock in the morning. The longest banquet went on for 4 days, and everyone invited to it dared not fall asleep before the dear leader went to bed. "It was torture for them," wrote Fujimoto in Kim Jong-il's Cook. He consumed vast amounts of alcohol, and once reportedly was told off by his old man for turning up to a meeting drunk. Jasper Becker reports that Soviet diplomats, the best informed, or rather the least in the dark, in Pyongyang, picked up rumors that Kim Jong-il may have picked up a drug habit, too. "Cocaine Kim" has the private eye ring of truth about it. The Soviet diplomats had heard that in the mid-1980s, Kim Jong-il attended several meetings in which he talked such a stream of gibberish that not even a personal translator could follow. Drugs could also account for Kim Jong-il's gibberish on the secret tape recording made by Shin and Che. At the very top of one of the most feared regimes in the world was a silly man babbling poppycock. And yet he managed to overcome his demons, alcohol or drug-induced, and stay in power until 2011, when he died in his bed, the only serious test of success for a tyrant. Even so, according to these witnesses, there was also something unhinged about the man, a little boy lost, engulfed by power, something in him, perhaps, that realized that everything he did and everything he stood for was fundamentally wrong. In 2008, he suffered a stroke. A photographer captured him scowling in his Mao casual wear, his face like a devil's, sick of sin. Chapter 15. 50 Shades of Green. I sit in a bar in Belfast and nurse my Guinness and listen to an IRA man tell me how he spent 2 months in North Korea in 1988 learning how to make bombs. There are three men, the go-between, Len, who went to Pyongyang, and another IRA man called Eddie. It's a little tense as we start. I have an Irish surname but an English accent, and my employer, the BBC, could not be more British. Into this awkwardness I find myself stumbling. Eddie leans forward, deadpan. "Before we start, John, I want you to know one thing. I'm a member of the Church of Scientology." I replied, "Fuck you." After we'd stopped laughing, I thanked the church for breaking the ice for me with all sorts of unlikely people. Len turned out to be a soft-spoken Irishman from West Belfast with a bone-dry wit. But there is a toughness about him, too. Back then, Len was, as he saw it, a soldier in an army, his general, Sean Garland, one of the great flawed heroes of Irish republicanism. There's an IRA ballad called Sean South of Gary Owen, which tells the story of a doomed attack on a Royal Ulster Constabulary barracks in 1957. Three IRA men were injured in the shootout. Under fire, Sean Garland carried Sean South on his shoulders in a hopeless attempt to save his friend's life. Garland escaped to the Irish Republic, but severely injured, ends up in hospital and, once recovered, Mountjoy Jail. The legend of Sean Garland, IRA hero, had started. Today, he is a sick and dying man. They call him Old Blue Eyes, and Len tells me he is one of the hardest men he has ever met. Come the start of the Troubles in 1969, the IRA split into two. The nationalist wing, the Provisional IRA, or Provos, set out to bomb their way to a united Ireland. The smaller, more avowedly socialist wing, the officials or stickies or sticks, after some hapless bloodshed, came to believe that civil war between nationalist and unionist working people was a disaster. The sticks were so-called because, to honour the East Rising in Dublin of 1916, they sported adhesive stick-on lilies. The provos used pin badges and are sometimes called the pinheads. Ideology restrained the sticky IRA from killing, but did not stop it completely. One estimate by the University of Ulster is that the officials killed 52 people during the Troubles, 23 civilians, 17 members of the security forces, 8 Republican paramilitaries, 3 of their own members, and a loyalist paramilitary. The lion's share of the murders happened in the early 1970s. The single worst outrage was the bombing of the Parachute Regiment headquarters in Aldershot in 1972, a revenge attack for Bloody Sunday when the paras shot dead 13 unarmed civil rights protesters in Derry, Londonderry. Instead of the intended target, the retaliatory car bomb killed 5 female kitchen staff, an elderly gardener, and the regiment's Catholic chaplain, Father Gerard Weston. Republican anger at the slaughter of civilians pushed the officials to announce that they would renounce violence and give up the ghost, a claim that wasn't quite correct. But from the time of the Aldershot bomb onwards, it is true to say that whatever else the sticks got wrong, they did not commit mass murder again. Had the sticks joined in with the provisional IRA's sectarianism, the story of the Troubles would have been far bloodier. 25 years later, the provos joined the sticks in questioning whether violence could pave the way to a united Ireland. In the meantime, 1,800 lives had been snuffed out. Garland was the king of the sticks, officially Secretary General of the Irish Workers' Party, which had real clout back then with the Soviet Union and its satellite states. The Soviets and their allies were wary of the provisional IRA, but treated Garland's Workers' Party seriously. As far as the public and the media were concerned, the official IRA had ceased to exist. In reality, they walked off into the shadows as Group B. Something of the Workers' Party's continuing paramilitary wing is told in The Lost Revolution, The Story of the Official IRA and the Workers' Party, a fascinating and scholarly investigation into a black hole of Irish paramilitarism by Brian Hanley and Scott Miller. But Hanley and Miller didn't get to meet a volunteer like Len. In October 1988, Len and 5 other sticks, all soldiers in Group B, flew from Shannon to Moscow. Their cover story was that they were studying at Moscow University, so to make that work, they wrote a series of postcards, which would be posted from Moscow while they were away. The official's go-between in Moscow was an Irishman, Fat Frankie. He smoothed their way and was extremely well-connected in the old Soviet Union. The word is that Fat Frankie once witnessed a fist fight in the back of a limo in Moscow between a high-up in the Workers' Party and Boris Yeltsin, both of whom had enjoyed perhaps one shandy too many. Neither Russian president nor Irish rebel was a clean winner. Fat Frankie also helped organize the Sticks' rather special method of fundraising, money-laundering fake $100 bills manufactured in North Korea, including sending a party of Irish Republican pensioners on holiday to the Black Sea, each carrying a small fortune in Pyongyang's finest U.S. dollar fakes. The Sticks stayed at North Korea's embassy in Moscow for a few nights. Then they were driven to the airport in a Mercedes with diplomatic plates. At the check-in desk, no passports were shown. They went straight through to their seats at the very front of the plane. No security for them. The flight was 14 hours, refueling in Siberia and then again in Beijing. They had been told to explain to anyone who asked that they were a group from the Maltese Communist Party, Malta 215, preposterous cover for six hefty, white-skinned, untanned Irishmen, though as a history professor, who am I to condemn a bunch of Maltesers? "How did you find Pyongyang?" I ask, so excited I almost shout. "Shh," Len said, and looked around the bar. No one was paying any attention, but just in case, I corrected myself. "How did you find Preston?" He smiled and told me his story. On landing, the rest of the passengers got off before Len and his men were taken in a small procession of Ministry of Interior Mercedes to a barracks about 30 miles north of Preston. Len guessed it was north of the capital because the sunset was on the right as they were driven along dirt roads up in the mountains. They ended up somewhere near a town called Mariban. Len remembered it phonetically, and there's nowhere spelt like that in North Korea. It was a military establishment, complete with a big parade ground. Len explained what happened at the very first briefing. "We were told through an interpreter that the North Koreans were helping with our revolution, but that we mustn't talk about our time here, ever." They wore suits, and each sported a badge with Kim Il-sung on it. Lecture over, the boys from West Belfast found a shop which sold beer in big green bottles. "That first night we had a good piss-up. The food was crap. They gave us dog soup once. There was a scrap of meat and it had dog fur on it." Len pulled a death mask face, rigid with disgust. "And chicken. They told us it was chicken, but the legs on these chickens were so small. Once on the parade ground, one of them said, 'There are your chickens,' and he was pointing to a bunch of crows." They were given North Korean officer uniforms, billeted two to a room, and taught how to salute, North Korean style, a kind of half-clawed gesture to the temple. "They told us about the Great Revolution, how they were fighting U.S. imperialism, the atrocities in the Korean Civil War. They also took down all our personal details. They asked us, 'If ever we wanted to call on you, would you say yes?' They've used people from here as couriers." Next came a medical examination, complete with chest X-ray, taken by equipment so old-fashioned it was straight from a cartoon, recalled Len. The North Koreans told the sticks about Juche-ism, but Len quickly came to his own conclusion. "That was an absolute load of fuck. Your man Kim Won, he was God." The military training started. They were taught hand-to-hand combat, a military